Hello, I'm Paul Johnson. I'm with The Optimistic American, and we're here today to talk about hope. Now, the title of this podcast is that the world is better than you think, and the United States is better than you could even possibly imagine. But there's a secret message here that we're really trying to get out, and it's the message about agency, how important agency is to you, the people that would like to take it from you, how they take it from you, how you sometimes willingly give it up, and how you can get it back. I'm here today with psychologist Emily Basha. Emily has helped us on putting together seven different steps that we're doing an individual podcast on each one of them as to how you can begin to restore your own agency. Emily, welcome today.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, such an important topic. You know, I see people in my clinical practice who relinquish control without even knowing it. And then they come in thinking, how did this happen? How do I empower myself? And that's what we're really here to do today, is to really give them the tools and the skills and the education to understand what's going in the mind and the body, the emotional processes. I've got some great research to talk about that I'm excited to share.
You always have great research to talk about.
But most important is back to free will.
By the way, I'm a politician. They say that we don't do facts. We just do opinions.
You guys, and we say if you torture statistics enough, you'll get it to say what you want it to say.
That's my business side. As an entrepreneur.
That's the political side. Oh, geez. Okay. We'll need a lifetime to unpack Paul.
There you go.
But really, we want to focus on empowering people. Getting back to free will and self-agency, and it's really about attuning themselves and using the parts of their brain that they're maybe not activating as well, integrating and synthesizing so that they're making sense of the information that's coming at them so they can make deliberate, conscious choices about what they want for themselves and their future.
Yes. All right. So here's what I do. I like starting with a story. And this story is one that talks about how you can lose agency. In fact, how I found that even I could lose some sense of agency. So a couple of months ago, I had a spreadsheet that I had to do for my business. The spreadsheet was going to take me about 5 or 6 days. So I knew that I had to spend significant time on it from about 3 o'clock until 8 o'clock at night, just focused on the spreadsheets. I'd watch that show CNN from 3 until 8, or at least peripherally watch it. And it was just amazing how much negative information there was on it. And it would draw me in every now and then. Fear about the country falling apart, fear about what was happening around the world, fear of what was happening with China, and a lot about what had happened with the Capitol riot. So every now and then I'd just turn over to Fox and see what they were talking about. And when I would get to Fox, you would have thought every single immigrant, every single citizen of Mexico or South America, Central America were coming across the border.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just bombarding people with this message about how much they should be afraid about immigration. Now, here's what it made me think about. When I was a little boy, 1969, the United States landed on the moon. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I would run home.
What a remarkable event.
Oh, it was an amazing thing. I would run home and I would turn on the television set to watch this. I can remember that I knew the name of every single astronaut, the names of their spouses. I knew the names of many of the NASA engineers.
They were your heroes.
They were our heroes, right?
Yeah.
And then I remember watching the takeoff. I mean, every minute, the countdown, all the way to the end. This sense of relief when we knew that they had gotten into outer space. Yeah. Then we watched the capsule turn itself around, and then the module ended up landing on the moon, and then they actually came back to Earth. Now, it was an amazing event, and everybody talked about it at school. Everybody I knew, this was something that just unified Americans. Interestingly enough, at 3 o'clock of that week, when I was sitting home watching CNN and flipping back to Fox every now and then, not spending the time on my spreadsheet that I probably should have been spending on it, there was this event that came on CNN where this spaceship Didn't seem like such a big deal, had gone into outer space. And this guy, William Shatner, who used to be the captain on Star Trek, is giving this speech where he's crying. There was no countdown. There was nothing talking about them in space. They didn't spend time going over the astronauts. Now, I would argue that event was almost as big as going to the moon. Why? Because it was the one of the first times. There was one flight that happened right before that, but it was one of the first times that the private sector had begun funding these flights. Mm-hmm. It's a huge event in the development of mankind. There are companies and individuals and people that are putting money into it. But instead, all we watched, the only thing that we watched, were these horribly negative things that were happening. Now, even if you go back to landing on the moon, we did it again in 1973. In 1973, it was the main coverage. That was during Watergate. Mm-hmm. Watergate got coverage, but there was an equal play that was taking place with going to the moon in 1973. What I see that's happening, and in fact, I had a chance to speak to a reporter from CNN, and it was a fun conversation. It was a roundtable, and in this conversation, I said to him, you know, what role do you have in inspiring people? He said, that's really not our role. That's the politician's role. Well, I disagree to begin with. I think they do play a role.
They have so much power and influence.
But more importantly, they're giving you information that's not correct. Here's where it's not correct. It's out of perspective. Certainly, all those issues that they're talking about are important. Mm-hmm. But you would think the only thing that was happening was negative. And it's interesting to me to think about why. Why did they do that?
Yeah, and it's misleading people's perspectives and the way that they're perceiving their reality. And you know, there's negative bias that's happening. And social marketers know this. There's a lot of psychological research that social marketers, political campaigners are also doing to see how to be able to attract people's attention. And it may just be split seconds that you have. And negative attention, things that are primed more towards negativity that is going to provoke your anxiety or your fight-flight response and enhance the amygdala in your limbic system, which is an automatic, primitive, instinctual response pattern in your brain, you're going to pay attention to it. Actually, research says 6 times more than positive information. So they're benefiting from showing you this negative biased information. And so now that we have this information, we know, okay, well, maybe I need to limit how much I watch. Maybe I need to censor what I'm watching of different stations. But be aware of how information that you're exposing yourself to is impacting how you're feeling. I saw that, you know, completely with everything that's been happening in the last year and a half, 2 years, and even things that are replaying it, hearing what people are talking about, that is just promoting that negative bias. People are affected by it in their day-to-day lives. Thoughts matter.
Yeah, they definitely do.
There's a really fascinating experimental study. I love to geek out on research here. Is it okay if I share it with
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
Okay. So there was this study where they were looking at two control groups, and they would give information about a politician who had inherited a bad economy, and there were 10,000 layoffs when that person came into power. So they said for one of the control groups, they called that like the positively primed group. They spin the information, although it still remained factually accurate, that that politician was still able to retain 60% of jobs. And they asked the participants, how do you feel about that politician? Most people felt very much in support of that politician. He was doing a good job. And in the other control group, it was more negatively skewed and primed. And it said, well, this politician had lost, you know, there were 40% of loss of jobs. And how do you feel about this politician? Well, most did not support that person. So now you've got two different groups. And the follow-up study in this section, they looked at, well, can we change how people feel about it? what if we presented some altering information or different facts? So they went back to the positively skewed group and they said, hey, even though this person, you know, managed to retain 60%, he lost 40% of jobs. How do you feel about him now? The majority of people withdrew their support for that politician. That is a powerful information from that study. They went to back to the negatively primed group and they said, okay, well, even though he lost 40%, he did maintain and retain 60%. How do you feel about him now? And most of them stayed.
Negative.
Still don't support. So you can see how powerful negative information is. It could even turn people's, even keeping all the facts accurate, they're not distorting any of the facts. The information remains the same. It's just how that information is delivered that is changing people's perceptions, their judgment, their decision making, and that has all set of consequences. And that was just one study.
So when I was running for office, I was mayor of the city of Phoenix. I ran for office a couple of times then, and then I used to like to say that I wanted to run for governor in the worst possible way, which was what I did because I lost. It's always the worst way. But
I'm sure you learned a lot. I'm sure it transformed you.
But I recall I spent a lot of time. I've been very active in a number of presidential campaigns, and I've met with some amazing people who have who were great marketing types. One of them explained this to me, and I will never forget. It's a little bit frightening to understand how they think and how they work, but I think it's also enlightening to understand it. She said to me that here's what happens with information. Mm-hmm. Information comes in to the brain through the ears, and its first stopping point, she called the amygdala, the reptilian portion of the brain.
Yes.
That information goes there, and it's analyzed as to whether or not it's an endangerment to you. And if it's an endangerment, that information never gets through to the neocortex. Now, she says when it gets through to the neocortex, people can rationalize and they can think, mm-hmm. and they can, that's where optimism comes from, that portion of the brain.
Intuition, creativity, mm-hmm. but, impulse control.
But yeah. Here was her point. We need to make certain that on our issues, we're getting our information to the neocortex, but on our opponent, we need to make certain that we're getting that information on them stuck in that reptilian portion of the brain. Mm-hmm. The point she was giving is that if you terrify people so much, the people who like you, about the opposition, they won't even listen to them.
Well, you're emotionally reasoning then rather than rationally or logically reasoning.
That's right.
Which is occupying different parts of the brain.
I look at this and say to the public, hey, start with this. Think about the information you're getting and the people who are giving it to you. What's their motive? Mm-hmm. All right. When a politician gives you information, mm-hmm. his motive is to get reelected or to get elected in the first place. It always is. Political parties represent special interests. They do things that are very unseemly that most people in the public would not like. And when they do see them and watch what's going on, they don't like at all. So what they have to do is convince you that the other side's just a little bit worse than them. That's what they need to convince you of, right? That being a part of that other side is a bad thing. Ideologies or political philosophies, they're designed to try to take that information inside of you and to make you terrified about the people who are on the other side. And news medias, they want you to stay with them.
Unfortunately, that gets reinforced because it works.
That's right. And so you get pounded with this information. Now, mm-hmm. I just gave you the information on NASA. One of the studies that happened, not studies, one of the issues that took place back when I was mayor, 1995, the United Nations said, hey, we're going to create a challenge. And the challenge is we're going to create these 8 standards. And what we want to see is whether or not we can cut poverty in half. And we're going to gauge it by these 8 standards. They hope to do it within a 20-year period of time. Now, this was what was amazing. In 15 years, they actually met their goal. They exceeded it. They were able to go way beyond what they thought they could possibly do. No one gave it real coverage. There were books that were written about this. This is where the book The Rational Optimist came from and Abundance came from. There were a whole series of books that started to look at this and go, wow, maybe things aren't as bad as we've been being told. And so they wrote these books. None of them got a Pulitzer. The Pulitzers all went to the people who were talking about the crime rate or about what was happening with droughts or any one of a number of other things, about the things that were going wrong in the world. Why? Well, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. That's the answer. But people need to understand that they're being fed information by a group of people who profit from that getting stuck in that reptilian portion of your brain. And once it's stuck there, that's when you begin to lose your agency, because you can't make a rational, optimistic decision.
Yes. And, you know, there are brains that are hardwired and neural tracks that are run through, and people can take advantage of that, especially if they're going to be priming the amygdala, the limbic system, and heightening that fight flight response. And so what we're saying here today is it doesn't have to be so. You can have a whole integrated brain, you know, with using this higher order of metacognition. It's amazing. We're the only species that can think about our thought process, that I can try and understand your intentions. And if you're trying to persuade me or trying to understand your motivations, and we have these higher emotional processes that are integrated with that. That's a phenomenal thing. Mm-hmm. And if we're not practicing it, we're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in one of the other podcasts, we've spoken about Solzhenitsyn, which is the Gulag Archipelago is definitely one of my favorite books. And it's one of my favorites because he talks really a lot about the idea of agency. He talks about that you have to gain agency back by recognizing first and foremost that good and evil exists in each one of us.
Yeah, going back to morality, here we go.
The very best person in the world has a little bit of evil in them. The very worst person has a little bit of good in them. And you have to recognize that in yourself, and that what ideologies are trying to do is they're trying to get you to export that evil so that you no longer have to be responsible for your actions. And in the name of that, people can do horrific things. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the genocides that have happened in the world came from those ideologies, but also other things that can come from that is how you treat people you care about, people that you love. Now, what I find to be fascinating is that Solzhenitsyn saw that good and evil as something that we're born with. But there's another book that came out just not too long ago called Sapiens. And Sapiens is about this concept that we create these moral constructs collectively. Meaning, when we created the idea of a government,
socially constructed,
we socially constructed this idea that, hey, I belong to a country and my country is good or my country is doing these things. The idea of a state, the idea of a corporation, religions. His opinion was that these constructs have helped us organize people. And I think that is true. We've been able to organize people in incredible ways through those organizations. And it's been very, I think, helpful to the species. But on the other hand, he believes, or at least my read of what he was saying was, we make this up. Mm-hmm. This isn't something that we're born with. To me, that's a fascinating question. Are we born with this morality, or is it something that is in that we gain over time?
Yeah, and philosophers and psychologists, scholars have really struggled with this question. I know that in looking at some of the more recent research on whether or not morality is innate or socially constructed, just kind of going through the evolution of it within psychology, Kohlberg looked at morality as part of a cognitive process, a developmental process. So it starts when you're an infant, and actually there's a lot of research showing that there's a genetic basis, but that there's different stages that you have to go through. And in a pre-conventional stage, most people are really looking at things as black and white and very dichotomous, and what is white, right, what is wrong, what is legal, what is illegal, and what does authority dictate. And then when you go to the conventional stage, which Kohlberg argued most people really remain at, it's about maintaining that social order and social harmony and peace. And so it's really for the greater good of the group. What is for the greater good of the group? And the post-conventional stage is that higher form of morality, that it's okay if you're infringing on rights that is for a greater good, such as human rights, promoting social justice, that there's these universal rights and responsibilities to protect all living things. And that is not black and white, you know, that you have to give up some values in order to maintain some other higher order values. And people who progress cognitively to that stage are really having to look at those conflicting values. And again, using that frontal lobe and thinking about things in a more complex way. Gilligan came back and challenged Kohlberg and said, well, wait a minute, you're missing the emotional process. And it was interesting that this was in the 20th century. And, you know, she was accused of being a feminist and this is a feminist value. And it really had nothing to do with that. It's like it's such an important component. But just the fact that she was talking about emotions, they made it such. And so now we know today, absolutely, it's a combination of cognition and emotions, it's thoughts, behaviors, it's not distinct, it's an integration of all
the
of those
morality
things.
Is tied to those. Now, again, that, you know, that what I think about with that is you can go all the way back to the Stoics a long time before then, during the Greeks, Aristotle, Plato, and others, and they actually had a definition for optimism and for pessimism. And optimism, they said that people who are optimistic have to believe that people are more good than they are evil, right? And they tend to believe that there's some type of established order that's bigger than us. Call that what you want, call that God, call that an order to the universe, whatever it is that you call it. But if there is an order, things tend to work out. The pessimist tended to believe that people were more evil than they were good, and there is no order to the universe, so things will not necessarily work out at all. All right, they won't be successful. You know, these Apple Watches, I thought I turned off everything I had, but the Apple Watch is still
ringing.
Is it
telling you to stand up or drink water?
All those things, right? So, but in any event, that whole idea, to me, if you begin to say, hey, morality is inside of each one of us, that also begins to say, hey, maybe there is an order to the universe, or whatever it is that you're going to call it. And that should give us some hope. Some belief that if all of us have a little bit of that in us, as Solzhenitsyn said, as I think Carl Jung said, as others have said, that it's actually ingrained in us, it means that there actually is some hope long term.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because cultural anthropologists have really struggled with this issue and looked at cross-cultural studies. And they found that there are certain things like incest and murder that are considered immoral, even going to just very remote areas in the world and pockets where it's tribes that really have no other influence with other people. And they found that there are some consistencies cross-culturally that there is a sense of morality that permeates all human species. There's some other, can I talk about some other really interesting research studies that have come across looking at this universality of morality that exists? And they were doing more neuroscience studies, and they found that, yes, in fact, there are different parts of the brain that are set up and encoded to assess information and be able to evaluate it as being ethical or moral. And so they looked at people with brain lesions in the frontal lobes of their brain, and they found that even if they didn't have emotions to process things such as feeling guilt or disgust to help inform them about whether or not acts were moral or immoral, that they still encoded the information and had some kind of moral reasoning to get to a judgment. And they may look at outcomes, you know, what is for the greater good. So they found that some people that really lacked some of those emotional processes said that it was okay to smother your own child if it was for a greater good. Whereas most people would feel emotionally salient things about that and say, oh no, how could you smother your own child?
Meaning the moral good might be that you're in a bunker and that you're about to be discovered by the Russians who's going to kill everybody else in the bunker if your baby cries.
Yeah, that's a good example. And they were also looking at people with different types of psychopathology, psychopathy. They looked at people who were incarcerated for terrorist activities. They looked at people with autism spectrum disorder. And they found that, okay, there is neurodiversity. The brain operates and functions in different ways. And what was fascinating with these studies is they were looking at theory of mind, going back to metacognition. Theory of mind is that we have this ability to try and discern another person's emotional states, their motivations, their intentions, their desires, because we have a sense of being. We have this ability to think about our thinking.
Okay, so let's tie this back to agency.
Yes.
All right, because here's the tie to me and agency. Inside of each one of us, we have a basic understanding of good and evil. It's basic, right? In every society in the world, there's an incest taboo. There's a murder taboo. There's certain basics that we kind of know that we have an obligation in terms of how we treat other people. And that seems to be fairly universal.
Yes.
However, it is also rational to think that way, to know that I need to treat other people this way because this is how I want to be treated. I want to be treated with dignity. I want equality. Mm-hmm. Those things are important to me. When you begin to insert ideology into the equation, it begins to remove that whole idea of good and evil being inside of you, and you begin to instead say, the other group is evil and I'm good. I can't tell you how many people I have today telling me Democrats who are saying Republicans are evil, Republicans who are telling me Democrats are evil, people who are saying, you know, Solzhenitsyn had to deal with the kulaks who were nothing more than farmers, and they decided they were evil because they own property, or people who are evil now today because they're in a corporation or because they're immigrants. You know better than that. Most people intuitively inside of them know that people are people. And if you don't allow ideology to begin to export that, it begins to make sense. And if you own your ideology, then you can begin to think more constructively about, really, is this information that I'm getting truthful? And I can tell you, overwhelmingly, the world is a lot better than you think, and the United States is better than you could ever possibly imagine.
Wow. You know, that makes me think, like, when you're talking about ideology, Brené Brown did a really great job on talking about people who hate you know, misery loves company, and so they may attract or be attracted to other people who hate the same people because it makes them feel better. The problem is they may be doing this on social media, and there isn't this benefit that's happening through social connection and love and belonging on more optimistic, positive reasons to have that connectedness. And there is not the benefit, and they're hurting themselves. And their thoughts
and the information they're getting is wrong. Right? The idea that we have people filled with dread about the United States, that we're filled with dread about how divided we are, that we're filled with dread about is China going to overcome the United States, that we're filled with dread about, is technology going to take my job? It's incorrect information. And that incorrect information is not only having an effect on your psychology, it's having an effect on you being able to understand what opportunities exist and how you can take advantage of those opportunities.
Yes. Yeah, and pessimism impacts our health. There are health risks associated with it. And conversely, you know, there are health benefits to optimism. There's research showing that people live longer being more optimistic. So you talked about, you know, having all of this data. Can you talk more about it to help educate, you know, nationally and also maybe on the world stage? What should we be feeling optimistic about? Okay, right.
Well, let's start with this. Let's start with what I think would be basic for most people.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, look at how divided our country is.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm reading every book I read. It talks about how divided we are. Well, there's a really good book called The Other Divide. The Other Divide, very, very bright authors. If you get a chance to pick up the book and read it, even if you watch some of the videos on it. But here's the concept. they've done a lot of polling to really look at the polls that are being done that show us divided, that show how divided we are. And they say those polls are incorrect because they're not asking the questions correctly. So they go through a series of the questions, but one that I thought was interesting was the concept of, they asked a Republican, if you knew that your son was going to marry a woman who was a Hillary supporter, mm-hmm. would you be opposed to the marriage? It's like 70 or 80% said yes. They then asked Democrats, if you knew that your daughter was going to marry a Trump person and that would you be opposed or would you be supportive of that marriage? About 70 or 80% of them said we'd oppose it. So the nightly news loves to play that divide and say, look at how divided we are in the country. 80% of the country wouldn't want their daughter or their son to marry somebody from the opposite party. Well, to begin with, the information's incorrect because in general, they're polling people who are high efficacy voters who vote in a Republican or Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with just looking at the numbers. 70% of the people are registered to vote. Inside that, 44% are independent. You're not counting those voters. You're pulling them out. You're acting as if those, we call them other voters, because Democrats and Republicans, the only thing they tend to hate more than Democrats and Republicans are the other guys. Well, I'm an other guy, right? I'm somebody who's not registered with a political party. I don't think it's anybody's business what my political party might be, but I can tell you what it is. I like the one of George Washington. I don't think you should have one whatsoever. But the point is this, you start by discounting them. Then you go to high efficacy voters, voters who are only going to vote in the primary. That's about 35%. So now you're talking about 70% times the 30% that are in a party, that gets you down to 20, such times the people who margin. Vote in the primary, mm-hmm. you're talking about 6% of the public, mm-hmm. right? This is one out of literally 1% or maybe 5% of the total population actually buys into that. And when they ask the question a little differently, when they say, instead of that, to the same group, when they say, hey, we want you to know that your daughter is looking at getting married to somebody who's age appropriate. They have a good education. They've got a good job. They make decent money. And they really love your daughter. But they're a Trump supporter. Even then, it drops down to 20%. So the point is, not only are they skewing the numbers, but they're skewing the way that they're asking the question. Why? Because if it bleeds, it leads. If they can convince you, you need to be terrified that this other group hates you and you need to be worried about them, then maybe you won't change that channel and watch the other station. Maybe you won't listen to people in the other party. Maybe that reptilian part of your brain gets so engaged that you won't take the next step. The point I will give you is you can go through this over and over again. I talk to Americans all the time. I talk to people who are pretty partisan on both sides and still find that you can find common ground. Unfortunately, when you watch what happens in the news, I mean, the only two people they cover, they cover ad nauseum, Green and AOC, the two people who are the most extremes of the party. Mm. They're not covering Mitt Romney or Kyrsten Sinema, mm-hmm. the people who are in the center. Why? Because it's not as exciting to cover them. And when they do, it's only because they know they're getting beat up within their own primary. So that's one area. Other areas, we had on Michael Beckley, who wrote a great book called Unrivaled. You can watch him on our on one of our podcasts on The Optimistic American. He has great information, and I highly recommend that you check it out if you get a chance. But if not, read his book. What he points out in his book is that the United States is an unrivaled superpower. And there are more economists than him saying that. The economist Kennedy has said that there's no superpower ever like the United States. When you start to compare us to China, one of the starting points I think that you should look at is how efficient are they? Because everybody wants to say, well, what's going to happen with China is their GDP is going to pass us up, which may be true. China's GDP may pass us up. But let's start with that equation. In the early part of the 19th century, China's GDP was almost double Japan's. They had a military twice the size. Japan defeated them in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. All right? How? Because GDP is the wrong factor to look at. When you think of China's GDP, start with this. 1 in 3 workers work in agriculture. 33% of their workers work in agriculture, and they're still importing goods for food. The United States, only 1% of our population works in agriculture. And we're exporting food. We're one of the largest exporters in the world. If you look at the demographics of China, the demographics of China is there are a whole bunch of people because of the one-child policy that are now getting into the older years and retiring and a younger population that has to take care of them. Yeah. What does it matter in your defense budget if you have even a bigger defense budget, but you're putting a larger portion of it into retirement, mm-hmm. into retirement funds? Not that retirement's not an important thing, but it doesn't do much to help you when you're fighting on the front. In the United States, we're the opposite. We, you know, people have given millennials a lot of grief. Yeah. We should be very grateful for millennials.
They're taking care of the
bigger than the boomer population, right? The boomer population was such a big population. There was an incredible fear that we weren't going to be able to pay for or feed their retirements. The millennials are beginning to take care of it. On demographics, we're incredibly better than our biggest rivals. Geographically, the United States is an economic fortress. We have Canada on one side, a very small border with Mexico on the other, and the Atlantic and Pacific on each side of us.
We're very fortunate with our territory.
When you go to China, first, their biggest border line that they have is with Russia. They've had somewhere near 30 violent skirmishes over border disputes with Russia. Mm-hmm. India, they have border disputes. Japan, Thailand, they are surrounded by people that disagree with them. Institutionally, there's nothing that irritates me more when one of my friends will tell me that China may actually do better than us because they have one person in charge and he can make a decision. As if one person making a decision for everybody is a better thing. I believe in the free market, not only of products, but the free market of ideas. When we put an idea out, it's a guarantee people disagree with you. They get into an argument with you. But that creates an ability for us to evaluate what is the truth and what is the best answer for a problem. I think institutionally we're dramatically better than they are. And last, the idea that we may lose the world's reserve currency. China has 2.3% of the world's reserve currency. We're somewhere near about 40%. The United States today in almost every economic factor is beating China. You know, we're 5% of the world's population, and overwhelmingly we make up the bigger than any other country, the amount of companies that are in the top percentage of groups, the highest amount of universities that are well performing. Our numbers are dramatically better than they are. But to be able to get that information, you have to do some research. You have to be willing to extend yourself out and understand that maybe the data that you're getting from the political parties, maybe the data that you're getting from candidates, and maybe the information you're getting from the news media is just not accurate. So last, what I would tell you is technology, and there's no doubt about this to me. Technology isn't going to harm our lives. It's going to dramatically improve it. So when we think about the idea that somehow or another technology may put me out of a job, and so people have been worried about what's going to happen in unemployment, look around. The opposite is happening. We have 8.4 million surplus of jobs today that we can't fill. My guess is that's going to get bigger. Now, things like inflation and potentially recession, they will happen. Inflation, there are two causes for inflation. One of them is that you have a lot of currency that was added during the Trump and Biden administration, and that definitely had an effect. They were effectively printing money through the Federal Reserve to help with stimulus because of COVID. But the bigger issue is all those millennials that we've been talking about, they're now starting to buy products. They're buying cars, they're buying houses, they're buying other things. That's good, right?
To help the economy.
But it increases demand. Supply is being negatively affected. China just in the last few weeks have closed down China literally for months because of COVID. It may be years because their vaccine's not working. And in addition, they have a bunch of workers that are retiring. Russia, we're not going to get the commodities as cheap as we could once get them because Russia was a big supplier of commodities, nickel and steel, as well as gas. Well, when supply is down and demand is up, you're going to have inflation. Inflation may last 4 or 5 years. There's some things that we should do to help prepare for that individually as well as from a national standpoint. But I can tell you this, the industrial output of the United States is going to increase because we're bringing those factories back home. And that's going to create a huge demand for labor. Millennials are in a great position today. Again, my point, you want your agency back? Start with, recognizing how wrong those groups are on their information.
You know, and it's just so powerfully influential, Paul. I think, you know, to some of my clinical populations I work with, very bright, professional, very well educated, and they're feeling very disillusioned living in America today. And I agree with you. I think a lot of the information that they're getting is making them feel very anxious and quite lost and disempowered. And so it does take work to look at this research and the data and finding it and saying, well, hold on, let me think about this holistically. Let me look at other information, other news media outlets, other things that are going to help me feel more safe, secure, and optimistic about my life, my nation, my family, my community, my future.
And to me, I think you have to start with this concept that it's up to you, right? One of my best friends when I was on the city council was a guy named Howard Adams. Howard Adams had a diving accident, I think in his 20s. I'm not sure of the age, but I know that he broke his neck and it made him a quadriplegic, and he could literally only operate one hand to drive his cart. He was a council person, and he was brilliant. He was definitely one of the movers and shakers on the council, sometimes to other people's chagrin because everybody didn't agree with what he had to say. But this guy came into the office every single day happy, singing, cheerful. And when he was putting together a deal, even if he didn't like the deal, he was having so much fun with it, you just couldn't help but fall in love with him. So one day I said to him, I said, Howard, I said, I just want you to know I really admire you. He says, why do you admire me? I said, Howard, oh my gosh. You at one point in time were a young, healthy person, and this happened to you. If that happened to me, I don't know that I could live through it. And he said, oh, Johnson. He said, if you think that all you're about is your arms and your legs, he said, you're much more handicapped than I am. He was an anomaly. He lived much longer than most quadriplegics live. And I am convinced it's because that optimism that he had, that belief in his ability to get things done, his sense of agency and self-empowerment made a difference. Now, to me, I could be wrong, but I think that optimism and having your own sense of agency really is helpful to your health.
Absolutely, and they go hand in hand. If you think about what is within your control and power to change, you're going to feel more hopeful and optimistic about what you're doing. You're going to feel more invested in terms of your time and energy into what you're doing. Think about the first thought when you wake up in the morning. Is it hopeful or is it pessimistic? Just think about that. And, you know, I encourage people to run a little experiment for themselves. See how that sets the pace for their day. And I would even go a step further and say, try and change it. Because there is a lot of research out there showing that there's neuroplasticity in the brain. We can change the brain. If these tracks are hardwired because of whatever trauma or experiences you've had in your past, and I've seen so much of it, you know, people have that same vitriol when they're talking about an experience that happened to them 10 years ago. My wife left me, my husband left me, something happened, something very tragic. But they're living their day-to-day existence as though that thing is still happening to them. We need to shift because that is no longer serving you, and you're going to remain lost and trapped and powerless with no sense of self-agency or control, and that's going to have detrimental effects on your stress, on your life, on your livelihood. And we're saying that it is possible to change. It's going to take hard work, deliberate choice, conscious effort, but it is possible.
You know, there's a great book. It was called Younger Next Year. Mm-hmm. And this book was written by a cellular biologist who talked a lot about the ways to keep yourself younger. Now, since then, there are a lot more studies. And
it's not Botox or plastic surgery.
Well, you know, if you listen to ever David Sinclair's stuff that he has, he's out of Australia, but he works out of Harvard. He's talking about trying to treat aging as a disease because he believes that we actually can dramatically limit or change the effects of aging. And he's done a lot of studies with mice.
Cellular reproduction.
But you know, he's getting amazing results. However, in this book, Younger Next Year, he did a study of mammals, and he talks about a lot of different mammals, but one of them was a herd of deer. And in a herd of deer, you'll always have one buck that's in the center and a bunch of young bucks that are on the outside of the herd that will stay out there by themselves, and they'll live just fine. But one day, one of the young bucks leaves the outside, and he goes to the inside. And when he goes to the inside, he'll challenge the major buck, and he'll beat him. And when that major buck leaves and goes to the outside, he never lasts more than 6 months. He dies. Mm-hmm. His mindset begins to have an effect on his body deteriorating. Now, we know that it is not a statistical anomaly that somebody who had been married for 50 or 60 years and their spouse dies, they die 6 months later. We know that that's more than a statistical anomaly, that that your health is actually tied to your state of mind.
Yeah, and if you lose status, that's in a, you know, you're operating on a loss paradigm. It takes work to be able to think, well, what is the meaning and purpose and the benefit or value of the status that I have now? How can I revamp my life, just as you gave the example with your friend Howard, to still have a meaningful contribution to society and still have a life worth living for? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's go through. Again, you helped us prepare the seven codes.
Yes.
And let's talk about those just for a moment. We've done an individual podcast on each one of them, or we're doing an individual podcast on each one of them, but I kind of want to summarize them because I think they're important. This first one really is about understanding what agency is about and the importance of knowing the truth, right? If you don't understand what your agency is, if you don't understand how the reptilian portion of the brain can hold you trapped and how other people can begin to utilize those emotions to keep you from thinking and keep you from being optimistic.
Through manipulation,
it's problematic.
Persuasion.
But sometimes it's enough of a jolt to just begin looking at alternative information to recognize that you've been being deceived. So lesson one, code one is, you need to understand what the truth is.
Yeah, and sometimes people really grow from trauma and loss. Mm-hmm. And that's where they really redefine who they are and rethink about their life and what is meaningful in their life.
Mm-hmm. The second one is understanding the power within you to start over, to begin anew, and how important it is that when you're going to begin anew, that you begin with love. Because if you begin with hate and anger and resentment, if you allow ideologies to begin to change your thought about how other people work, that holds you back. It keeps you from seeing the potential and what's in front of you. And then the third one is the ability to be unique, right? In the ability to be unique, you need to focus on meaning. I think we put way too much of a focus on our desire to be happy. If you want to be happy, certainly I think growth is one of the great ways that you will find happiness, but meaning is much more important. This is a guarantee. There will be times in your life when you will be unhappy. You just will be. Your parents pass away or something happens to you that's bad. You go through a divorce. You will go through unhappiness. But even during those moments, you can still have meaning.
Yeah, I had talked about, you know, my family's survival of what had happened to them with the persecution, political persecution, religious persecution, and living in Iraq. And their resilience and their courage and their, I mean, it's such extreme humility. They're so humble and so hardworking and so loving and giving. And I think to them as such a model for, you know, how I want to live my life. And I also strive to be, and so selfless. They could have lived trapped in that victim mindset and pissed off and resentful at the world. But they allowed themselves to transform. I work with a lot of people who have survived horrific things, murder of a child, long-term incarceration, and they still find that their life is worth living for and they're deserving of happiness. But they find happiness through creating a life worth living for and finding meaning and purpose and creating connection. We found lots of research around social alienation as being such a detriment to people. So again, going back to, you know, it's part of that process of beginning anew, but finding purpose and meaning.
And I think the word connection is important because that's our next one, which is love and connection. Mm-hmm. People need love and connection. In fact, it's probably one of the biggest things most of us are in search of. But you're not going to find love and connection if you're still tied into the past. You can't find, you're not going to find connection by hatred. It's just not going to be there.
Or if you're living life as an imposter, sometimes people really, you know, they have that dark passenger living within inside of them, and they fear if people really knew who I was, they wouldn't love me. So let me just be this other person that people seem to like and adore and admire more. But that's adversely affecting their innate belief about themselves as being not lovable.
And I think this is one of the problems with social media. Mm-hmm. I think people go on to
very much so
into social marketing, and they say, well, I have my friends, people friended me, and people like what it is that I'm saying. And so they begin to believe that they can find a sense of connection by identifying with people that they hate. I just don't think that that's possible. In fact, I'm positive that it's not. I'm also positive that oftentimes people, as they begin to tie into those ideologies and tie into those groups, they then go home and get into a fight with their brother-in-law about Donald Trump or about Nancy Pelosi or about something that's happening politically. They start giving up on the people that they love for the people they don't even know.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and taking risks in your life and living life with courage and confronting the harder parts of yourself. We learn more about ourselves when we're going through struggle. And people feel more connected to us when we're sharing those vulnerable parts of us. And, you know, I love your story when you're talking at the last podcast about, you know, your strength and character and where that came from in your family and the hardships that you lived and how you really worked through those struggles. Because I think it's a really great example. And everyone has those stories. It's just a matter of finding them, picking them out and saying, you know what, that is courage.
Yeah. And that idea of strength, again, is our next item, which is our fifth item. But that relates to growth. There's no doubt when we can grow inside, when we can begin to see progress with ourselves, you will find a much higher degree of happiness than when you're going in the other direction, right? And you can be growing spiritually, intellectually, physically, but growth is very helpful. The single biggest key is that we're putting way too big of a focus with our children, with society, in our schools, on the idea of safety. We need to put a much bigger focus on strength. That, to me, is my reason for being opposed to the cancel culture. It's not just that the cancel culture is doing terrible things to individuals that are their targets. It's that they're doing terrible damage to themselves. You need to be resilient. You need to be able to confront challenges in life. I want my children to be able to do that. And to do that, you have to be able to talk with people that maybe you don't always agree with. You have to learn to be able to talk with them. That's going to help you in business, in your personal relationship, and it is going to make you mentally stronger.
Yes, absolutely, because we don't want to teach people to live in this pretend world or pretend reality. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think psychology also has a bad rap and also isn't understood correctly or oftentimes not applied correctly. And the idea is people need to build skills, and you're not going to build skills if you're constantly living in the basement, gaming all day long, and connecting with people on social media. Mm-hmm. You're not going to gain skills in that world. Mm-hmm. And it can be small steps. It can be baby steps. But you need to venture out. You need to challenge yourself. You need to gain information. You need to test yourself.
Yeah. And I know that you and I have listened to a couple of other podcasts where we've seen and heard psychologists who were spending more time trying to promote the ideas of people being a victim than they were in trying to actually get them to take accountability for themselves and how they can help themselves. Well, that's part of why
Absolutely.
Strength is important.
Yes.
Contribution is the sixth one, which is, by the way, it's the single biggest one. You know from other past podcasts that we've done, I like the 12 steps. You call it the psychological six steps, I think it is. But that giving back, that the last step, you have to do something for other people. The idea of we, not me, and recognizing that that we need to honor our heroes, the people who come from our past. They need to be something that we're proud of and that we can talk about. and that you belong to something bigger. And that thing that is bigger, at least here in the United States at this point in time, it is awesome. It's unbelievable what you're a part of today.
Yeah, and that you have the power to create the world that you want to live in. And it doesn't mean, we're not saying to be Pollyannish. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are living in with avoidance. And we want people to be informed and see reality for what it is. But knowing that you have the power to influence your life, your longevity, create the world that you want to be in, join and merge with people who have a similar vision, not be afraid of difficult conversations, that there is so much that you can do. And you can feel optimistic and hopeful and powerful and believe.
And that's, I don't know how you do it. The last word of everyone you've had got to the next one. The most important thing, the last one, the seventh code. Is you have to believe.
Amen.
Yes. What I find in believing, again, I'm going to go back to that story a moment ago with Sapiens, the book Sapiens. Mm-hmm. In his book, one of the things that he pointed out was that all these things were a myth, right? That religion, government, states, corporations, that all those things were constructs that we made up. And we had to talk about that and saying, well, at least as it relates to morality and good versus evil, I'm not quite sure that that's true. But in his book, he stresses the importance of people believing, meaning if they quit believing in their country, if they quit believing that things are getting better, if they quit believing in society, if they quit believing in their family, if they quit believing in their business, guess what? It goes away. Our monetary system.
Mentality.
It's all based upon belief. So the first thing is, once you begin to recognize how good of a position we're in, then you know that you have something that you shouldn't want to lose, because this is the best time to be alive. There's no better time to be alive than in the United States today. There's no better time, no better place. But what I see that's happening is that, you know, I've been all around the country. I've been all around the world for that matter. And especially in our country, I've found in lots of places where people are losing the sense of agency, and they're losing faith and belief in who we are. Mm-hmm. And they're losing faith and belief in terms of what it is that we can do. They no longer have hope that we can make things better. My whole reason for the optimistic American, it really comes down to this one. I still believe.
Yeah, that's why we're here.
I just, in
that's
fact,
why
believe
you're doing
that,
this.
That we can make things better.
Absolutely. Do I have time to end on a meditation?
Sure.
Okay. All right. I'll keep it short.
Yeah, tell us why we're doing this.
Okay. So we do want to create neural tracks in the brain. And so again, if things are hardwired, especially primed for that negativity bias, you have to work to be able to create new neural tracks. And so there's research in doing that, meditation, visualization, and manifestation can help to do that. If you can create a daily practice, it can even be as short as 30 seconds a day or as much as 5 minutes a day. There's benefit and value to this. So if you would like to join me,
all right,
closing your eyes and focus on love, whatever that is for you. It can be love for a pet, love for a human, love for a child. And really now try and envision this giving and receiving of love. Allow that love to flow through your body, almost from your head to your face, down your back and your chest and your belly, all the way down through your legs, all the way to the bottom of your feet. Really just be enveloped with this energetic love. Now, I want you to think of something hopeful, something that maybe brings some energy or excitement. It could even be something you're manifesting for the future, something you're really wishing or willing to happen. Really hold on to that notion. Now, allow that to permeate your body and allow your thoughts to really envelop this, your emotions to really envelop this. And think about how you might be acting differently, maybe more confidently, maybe with more relief, with more hope or belief. more gentleness, more compassion. Really breathe into that space. Now you can, and there is some research showing that this can be helpful. You can open your eyes and you can place your hand on the back of your neck and your forehead if you want. And holding your head steady, you can be looking from side to side to allow your brain and hemispheres to be more integrated as you're really holding on to this notion of belief and hope and change for the betterment. And coming back. So I want to share an experience that I had when I was first doing this activity. My mom's been struggling with some physical health issues and mobility issues and some hip joint problems and pain. And it's really limited her ability to walk freely. And, you know, there's signs of aging. And I found myself getting angry at her getting older. And it was coming through in the way that I was talking to her. I found myself being more short-tempered, pressuring her to go to the doctor, pressuring her to eat healthier, pressuring her to want to exercise more and do all of these things. And I wasn't really understanding or appreciating the pain that she was in. I was getting angry at the pain, like, how dare it limit my mother? And I realized being confronted with her aging process and being confronted with death, I started bargaining with death. Like, how dare you, you know, change my mom? I want the mom I know. And once I realized that, it was like an aha moment for me. I realized I was being such a big jerk. And I said, oh my gosh, no, I have to change my process. She has the right to choose how she limits her day-to-day based on how she's feeling. And she has the right to choose which doctor she wants to go to and how she wants to approach her health. And I realized I was trying to take away her self-agency over her own being and body. And I was pressuring her. And it was unfair that I was doing that. Once I realized that, I felt liberated. I felt relieved. I felt like, wait, I get to exercise this moment to moment with my mom and enjoy and appreciate every moment I have. I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but sure, she's aging. And as much as I deny it or fight with it, that's not going to help me. And so there was this mutual benefit that was happening that I felt relieved that, you know, this isn't something in my control. Mm-hmm. And once I did that, there was great benefit and value to me and also seeing the great benefit and value to our relationship because I had a different mindset now and different perspective in my approach mm-hmm. to her.
Well, I think that fits everything that we just said today, yeah. Right? The idea that you had this piece of information that's getting stuck in the reptilian portion of your brain, fear of something going wrong with your mom. It's mm-hmm. overpowering because you love
fear
her
of
so
aging.
Much.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of then helping your relationship through that, you begin to harm your relationship
Absolutely.
Through that because that fear is so big for you that you're reacting incorrectly with her.
And I was justifying it for myself.
You're exporting your evil.
Mm-hmm.
You're exporting the evil mm-hmm. inside of you, mm-hmm. which is this fact that you're just not confident about life without her into being something that you penalize or punish her for what she's doing all along, not making your life better.
Because
being
I'm afraid.
Being able to utilize rational thought mm-hmm. and optimism begins to give you back agency. Now, the whole idea of that meditation, I don't think this, I know this. I have found that I begin to build up patterns. If I start to get mad at somebody mm-hmm. and then I stay mad at them, I treat them bad 3, 4, 5 times, I'll treat them bad 25 times. All right, this pattern begins to build up inside of my head that responds to them in a way in which is negative. If I want to reverse that, I have to recognize the role that I play and to believe that I can make a difference. Emily, we're out of time today. Thank you so
Thank
much for
you,
coming
Paul.
On. We'll finish up all these other podcasts. Again, this is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American, and I hope that you thought that we talked about hope today.